Continuing chapter 22 of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. So Sirius had just said, "Accio, Butterbeer." He raised his wand as he spoke, and half a dozen bottles came flying toward them out of the pantry, skidding along the table, scattering the debris of Sirius's meal, I guess. And stopping neatly in front of the six of them. They all drank, and for a while, the only sounds were those of crackling fire of the kitchen and the soft thud of the bottles on the table. Harry was only drinking to have something to do with his hands. His stomach was full of horrible, hot, bubbling guilt. They would not be here if it were not for him. They had all been still asleep in bed, and it was no good telling himself that by raising the alarm, he had ensured Mr. Weasley had been found. Because there is also the inescapable business of it being he who had attacked Mr. Weasley in the first place. "Don't be stupid, you haven't got fangs," he told himself, trying to keep calm, though the hand on his butterbeer was shaking. "You were lying in bed, you weren't attacking anyone." "But then what just happened in Dumbledore's office?" he asked himself. "I felt like I wanted to attack Dumbledore, too." He put down the bottle a little harder than he meant to, and it slopped over onto the table. No one gave any notice. A burst of fire in midair illuminated the dirty plates in front of them, and as they gave cries of shock, a scroll of parchment fell with a thud onto the table, accompanied by a single golden phoenix tail feather. "Fox," said Sirius at once, snatching up the parchment. "That's not Dumbledore's writing. It must be a message from your mother. Here." He thrust the letter in George's hand, who ripped it open and read aloud. "Dad is still alive. I'm setting out for St. Mungo's now. Stay where you are. I'll send news as soon as I can." George looked around the table. "Still alive," he said. "But that makes a sound." He didn't need to finish the sentence. It sounded to Harry, too, as though Mr. Weasley was hovering somewhere between life and death. Still exceptionally pale, Ron stared at the back of his mother's letter, as though it might speak words of comfort to him. Fred pulled the parchment out of George's hands and read it for himself, and then looked up at Harry, who felt his hand shaking on his butterbeer bottle again, and clenched it more tightly to stop the trembling. If Harry ever sat through any longer night than this one, he couldn't remember it. Sirius suggested once, without any real conviction, that they all go to bed, but the Weasleys' looks of disgust were answer enough. They mostly sat in silence around the table, watching the candle wick sinking slower and lower and lower into liquid wax, occasionally raising a bottle to their lips, speaking only to check the time, to wonder aloud what was happening, and to reassure each other that if there was bad news, they would know straight away. Mrs. Weasley must long have arrived at St. Mungo's. Fred fell into a doze, his head lolling sideways on his shoulder. Ginny was curled like a cat on her chair, but her eyes were open. Harry could see them reflecting the firelight. Ron was sitting with his head in his hands. Whether awake or asleep, it was impossible to tell. Harry and Sirius looked at each other every so often. Intruders on the family grief, waiting and waiting. At 5:10 in the morning, by Ron's watch, the kitchen door swung open, and Mrs. Weasley entered the kitchen. She was extremely pale. But when they all turned to look at her, Fred, Ron, and Harry, half rising from their chairs, she gave a wan smile. "He's going to be all right," she said, her voice weak with tiredness. "He's sleeping. We can all go and see him later. Bill's sitting with him now. He's going to take the morning off." Fred fell back into his chair with his hands over his face. George and Ginny got up, walked swiftly over to their mother, and hugged her. Ron gave a very shaky laugh and downed the rest of his butter beer in one. "Breakfast," said Sirius loudly and joyfully, jumping to his feet. "Where is that accursed house elf? Creature! Creature!" But Creature did not answer the summons. "Oh, forget it, then," muttered Sirius, counting the people in front of him. So it's breakfast for, let's see, 7, bacon and eggs, I think, some tea and toast. Harry hurried over to the stove to help. He didn't want to intrude on the Weasley's happiness, and he dreaded the moment when Mrs. Weasley would ask him about his vision. However, he had barely taken the plates from the dresser when Mrs. Weasley lifted them out of his hand and pulled him into a hug. "I don't know what would have happened if it hadn't been for you, Harry," she said in a muffled voice. "They might not have found Arthur for hours. Then it would have been too late. But thanks to you, he's alive, and Dumbledore has been able to think up a good cover story for Arthur being where he was. You've no idea what trouble he would have been in otherwise. Look at poor Sturgis." Harry could hardly bear her gratitude, and fortunately she released him to turn to Sirius and thank him for looking after her children through the night. Sirius said he was very pleased to have been able to help and hoped they would all stay with him as long as Mr. Weasley was in the hospital. "Oh, Sirius, I'm so grateful. I think he'll be there a little while. It would be wonderful to be nearer, of course. That might mean we're going to be here for Christmas." "The more the merrier," said Sirius with such obvious sincerity that Mrs. Weasley beamed at him, threw on an apron, and began to help with breakfast. "Sirius," Harry muttered, unable to stand it a moment longer. "Can I have a quick word? Now." He walked into the dark pantry, and Sirius followed. Without preamble, Harry told his godfather every detail of the vision he had had, including the fact that he himself had been the snake who had attacked Mr. Weasley. When he paused for breath, Sirius said, "Did you tell Dumbledore this?" "Yes," said Harry impatiently, "but he didn't tell me what it meant. Well, he didn't tell me anything anymore." "I'm sure he would have told you if there was anything to worry about," said Sirius steadily. "But that's not all," said Harry, in a voice only like a little above a whisper. "Sirius, I think I'm going mad. Back in Dumbledore's office, just before we took the portkey, for a couple of seconds, I thought I was a snake. I felt like one. My scar really hurt when I was looking for Dumbledore. When I was looking at Dumbledore. Sirius, I wanted to attack him." He could only see a sliver of Sirius's face. The rest was in darkness. "It must have been the aftermath of the vision, that's all," said Sirius. "You were still thinking the dream, or whatever it was." "It wasn't that," said Harry, shaking his head. "It was like something rose up inside me, like there's a snake inside of me." "You need to go to sleep," said Sirius firmly. "You're going to have breakfast, then go upstairs to bed, and after lunch you can go and see Arthur with the others. You're in shock, Harry. You're blaming yourself for something you only witnessed, and it's lucky you did witness it, or Arthur might have died. Just stop worrying." He clapped Harry on the shoulder and left the pantry, leaving Harry standing alone in the dark. Should we stop, or? How are you doing, Katie?
Okay.
Everyone but Harry spent the rest of the morning sleeping. He went up to the bedroom and he and Ron had shared over the last few weeks of the summer, but while Ron crawled into bed and was asleep within minutes, Harry sat, fully clothed, hunched against the cold metal bars of the bedstand, keeping himself deliberately uncomfortable, determined not to fall into a doze, terrified that he might become the serpent again in his sleep, and wake up to find that he had attacked Ron or else slithered through the house after one of the others. When Ron woke up, Harry pretended to have enjoyed a refreshing nap, too. Their trunks arrived from Hogwarts while they were eating lunch, so they could dress as muggles for the trip to St. Mungo's. Everybody except Harry was riotously happy and talkative as they changed out of their robes and into jeans and sweatshirts. When Tonks and Mad-Eye turned up to escort them across London, they greeted them gleefully, laughing at the bowler hat Mad-Eye was wearing at an angle to conceal his magical eye, and assuring him, truthfully, that Tonks, whose hair was short and bright pink again, would attract far less attention on the underground. Tonks was very interested in Harry's vision of the attack on Mr. Weasley, something Harry was not remotely interested in discussing. "There isn't any seer blood in your family, is there?" she inquired curiously, as they sat side by side on a train rattling toward the heart of the city. "No," said Harry, thinking of Professor Trelawney and feeling insulted. "No," said Tonks musingly. "No, I suppose it's not really a prophecy you're doing, is it? I mean, you're not seeing the future, you're seeing the present. Odd, isn't it? Useful, though. Harry didn't answer. Fortunately, they got out at the next stop, a station in the very heart of London, and in the bustle of leaving the train, he was able to allow Fred and George to get between himself and Tonks, who was leading the way. They all followed her up the escalator, Moody clinking along at the back of the group, his bowler hat tilted low and one gnarled hand stuck in between the buttons of his coat, clutching his wand. Harry thought he sensed the concealed eye staring hard at him. Trying to avoid any more questions about his dream, he asked Mad-Eye where St. Mungo's was hidden. "Not far from here," grunted Moody, as they stepped out into the wintry air on a broad, store-lined street packed with Christmas shoppers. He pushed Harry a little ahead of him and stumped along behind. Harry knew the eye was rolling in all directions under the tilted hat. Wasn't easy to find a good location for a hospital. Nowhere in Diagon Alley's big enough. We couldn't have it underground like the ministry. It wouldn't be healthy. In the end, they managed to get hold of a building up here. Theory was, sick wizards could come and go and just blend in with the crowd. He seized Harry's shoulder to prevent them from being separated by a gaggle of shoppers, plainly intent on nothing but making into a nearby shop full of electronic gadgets. "Here we go," said Moody a moment later. They'd arrived outside a large, old-fashioned, red-brick department store called Purge and Dowse Limited. The place had a shabby, miserable air. The window displays consisted of a few chipped dummies with their wigs askew, staring at random and modeling fashions at least 10 years out of date. Large signs on all the dusty doors read, "Closed for refurbishment." Harry distinctly heard a large woman laden with plastic shopping bags say to her friend as they passed, "Never open that place." "Right," said Tonks, beckoning them toward a window, displaying nothing but a particularly ugly female dummy. Its false eyelashes were hanging off, and it was modeling a green nylon pinafore dress. "Everybody ready?" They nodded, clustering around her. Moody gave Harry another shove between the shoulder blades to urge him forward, and Tonks leaned close to the glass, looking up at the very ugly dummy, her breath steaming up the glass. "Watcher, we're here to see Arthur Weasley." Harry thought how absurd it was for Tonks to expect the dummy to hear her talking so quietly through a sheet of glass, with buses rumbling along behind her and all the racket of a street full of shoppers. Then he reminded himself that dummies couldn't hear anyways. You know, has he not spent 5 years in a world of magic? Next second, his mouth opened in shock as the dummy gave a tiny nod and beckoned with his jointed finger, and Tonks had seized Ginny and Mrs. Weasley by the elbows, stepping right through the glass and vanished. Fred, George, and Ron stepped after them. Harry glanced around at the jostling crowd. Not one of them seemed to have a glance to spare at the window displays, as ugly as those on Purge and Dowse's Limited. Nor did any of them seem to have noticed that 6 people just melted into thin air in front of them. "Come on," growled Moody, giving Harry yet another poke in the back, and together they stepped forward through what looked like a sheet of cool water, emerging quite warm and dry on the other side. There was no sign of the ugly dummy or the space where she had stood. They were in what seemed to be a crowded reception area where rows of witches and wizards sat upon rickety wooden chairs, some looking perfectly normal and perusing out-of-date copies of Witch Weekly, others sporting gruesome disfigurements such as elephant trunks or extra hands sticking out of their chests. The room was scarcely less quiet than the street outside. Many of the patients were making very peculiar noises. A sweaty-faced witch in the center of the front row, who was fanning herself vigorously with a copy of the Daily Prophet, kept letting off a high-pitched whistle as steam came pouring out of her mouth. A grubby-looking warlock in the corner clanged like a bell every time he moved, and, with each clang, his head vibrated so horribly that he had to seize himself by the ears to hold it steady. Witches and wizards in lime-green robes were walking up and down the rows, asking questions and making notes on clipboards like umbrages. Harry noticed the emblem on their chests, a wand and a bone crossed. "Are they doctors?" he asked Ron quietly. "Doctors," said Ron, looking startled. "Those muggle nutters that cut people up? Nah, they're healers." "Over here," called Mrs. Weasley, above the renewed clanging of the warlock in the corner. They followed her to the queue, in front of a plump blonde witch, seated at the desk marked Inquiries. The wall behind her was covered in notices and posters, saying things like, "A clean cauldron keeps potions from becoming poisons," and "Antidotes are anti-don'ts, unless approved by a qualified healer." There was also a large portrait of a witch, with long silver ringlets, which was labeled Dillis Derwent, St. Mungo's Healer, 1722 to Headmistress of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, 1741 to... Dillis was eyeing the Weasley party closely as she counted them. When Harry caught her eye, she gave a tiny wink, walked sideways out of her portrait, and vanished. Meanwhile, at the front of the queue, a young wizard was performing an odd, on-the-spot jig and trying, in between yelps of pain, to explain his predicament to a witch behind the desk. "It's these, ouch, shoes my brother gave me. Ow, they're eating my, ouch, feet. Look, ouch, there's some kind of, jinx on them, and I can't get them off." He hopped from one foot to the other as though dancing on hot coals. "Those shoes don't prevent you reading, do they?" said the blonde witch, irritably pointing at a large sign on to the left of her desk. "You want spell damage fourth floor, just like it says on the floor guide. Next." As the wizard hobbled and pranced out of the way, the Weasley party moved forward a few steps, and Harry read the floor guide. "Artifact, accidents, ground floor. Cauldron explosion, wand backfiring, broom crashes, etc. Creature-induced injuries, first floor. Bites, stings, burns, embedded spines, etc. Magical bugs, second floor. Contagious maladies, for example, dragon pox, vanishing sickness, scrofulongus, etc. Potion and plant poisoning, third floor. Rashes, regurgitation, uncontrollable, etc. Spell damage, fourth floor. Unliftable jinxes, hexes, and incorrectly applied charms, etc. Visitor's tea room and hospital shop, fifth floor. If you're unsure where to go, incapable of normal speech, or unable to remember why you are here, our welcome witch will be pleased to help. A very old, stooped wizard with a hearing trumpet had shuffled to the front of the queue. "I'm here to see Broderick Bodhi," he wheezed. "Ward 49, but I'm afraid you're wasting your time," said the witch dismissively. "He's completely addled, you know. Still thinks he's a teapot. Next." A harangued-looking wizard was holding his small daughter, tightly by the ankles while she flapped around his head, using an immensely large feathery wings that had sprouted right out through the back of her romper suit. "Fourth floor," said the witch in a bored voice, without asking, and the man disappeared through the double doors behind the desk, holding his daughter like an oddly shaped balloon. "Next," and Mrs. Weasley moved forward to the desk. And I think we'll stop there. Hope you like that cute. Sleep well, kitten. I love you so much. You're a sweet lover bug. Good night, baby girl.